Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's really a pleasure to be here among so many committed people who at 3 o'clock in the, on Saturday afternoon, have shown up. And speaks to what Woody Allen said, that 95% of life is about showing up. And so we've done that. It's also my privilege, my name is Barbara Vakar, to be the president of Goddard College. Goddard is one of the first progressive experimenting colleges in this country. And I'm going to stop for a moment just so that my fellow panelists can just introduce themselves briefly.
I'm Julie Martin. I'm the Dean for Advancement at Goddard, which means I do everything external. And I'm curious, how many have ever heard of Goddard or expend Goddard or, yes, great.
Or wanted to go to Goddard.
I'm Hillary Montgomery. I'm the Associate Director of Development and a student in the psychology program.
I'm Gustavo Peluso. I've been on the faculty of the education program for the last 20 years.
And I'm Adam Burke. I earned my master's in arts and education at Goddard.
So as I said, Goddard was one of the first progressive experimenting colleges in this country, and a college that in my mind is increasingly important today as we are, I think we would all agree, in desperate need of a citizenry who are critical thinkers and who know how to engage in a critical inquiry. And so I'd like to begin our presentation, which will be interactive at some point, by sharing a bit about our history and that will illuminate something about who we are as a community, as a college, and as a process of learning and as a process of inquiry. Let me also just say that it's really exciting to be here, to be exploring the intersections between humanist philosophy and the values that have lived in the bones of Goddard since its inception. And we're here because of a number of conversations that we've had with representatives of the Humanist Association who came to Goddard to explore that with us as we think about how we might solidify this at the college as a way of enhancing what we do, but also as a way of enhancing what the American Humanist Association does. Oh, we are in Plainfield, Vermont, and in Port Townsend, Washington. So we're on both coasts. So as I said, I'm going to start with just a little bit of our history. The roots of Goddard College traverse three centuries, but I'm going to locate us in 1938 when the college was founded in its current iteration as Goddard College. And it's interesting to think about its founding in relationship to the conversation that you've been having, we've been having for the past couple of days, and the values that are at the heart of this association. On March 15, 1938, Tim Pitkin, the founding president of the college, in his speech to the community, engaged in an analysis and raised a question. And that is truly at the heart of the process of education at Goddard College. And his analysis was that we are in need of more intelligent thinking. And his question was, what are we going to do about it? Goddard was the answer. Goddard was his answer, the community's answer, and it remains an answer to that question at a time when we might ask the very same question today. The college and the process of education at the college is inspired by John Dewey and William Hurt Kilpatrick's ideas about experience and learning, and inspired by the science and philosophy of Darwin and William James. The college, as I said, has always been and continues to be an experiment in living and learning, concerned with democracy, with human development, and with applying learning and development to the solutions of real problems in the world and in our democracy. And I want to read to you what was written in the first catalog of the college in 1938, where the aims of the college were described as including the education of men and women for real living through the actual facing of real life problems. Education at Goddard is transactional, it's transformative, it's reconstructive, and it's consequential. And we're going to have you engage in that in a few moments, but I think I'd like to lay the groundwork for that a little bit by just giving you snippets of what has lived at Goddard since its inception. And it's in its original mission statement, it talked about, it described learning at Goddard as a place where people will learn, think, and act with intelligence and responsibility in such a way that they will be increasingly active in improving the physical, social, cultural, political, economic, and spiritual conditions of persons everywhere, and in restoring and creating a life-enhancing environment. In a draft mission statement, in 1991, so you're seeing the evolution, Goddard described itself in this way. In a world beset by ecological threat and economic injustice, Goddard imagines a different world, one that will live by principles of democracy and sustainable development, and will respect the rights of the individual as well as cultures within a global community. Goddard seeks students who see the whole and care about it. To prepare all its members as world citizens, Goddard continually experiments to find a curriculum that is problem-centered, holistic, and committed to critical thinking about our world and our place in it. Encouraging academic generalism, Goddard asks its students to understand themselves in the world, to communicate genuinely and with mutual respect, and to contribute to the well-being of the planet and its many cultures, thus to try to make the world work for everyone in it. It's a mouthful. Finally, what I would like to say about Goddard today and in its past, as we move to really talk about the process of education, is that Goddard furnishes a place, wherever it is located, and a time for inquiry. I think we would call it deep and rigorous inquiry. The major thing that Goddard aims to teach, aims to help you learn, is how to carry out that inquiry about yourself, the world, yourself in the world. Only through learning how to learn, as opposed to what to learn, and helping others learn, how to clarify needs and the problems they generate, how to use books and experiments and dialogue and experience to deal effectively, cooperatively, and responsibly with those needs and problems, how to draw informed conclusions from the experiments and convert the conclusions into responsible social action. Only through such learning is humankind likely to survive. And at Goddard, we look at knowledge as being co-constructed, always co-constructed between the students, the faculty, peers, and with the texts, with the outside world, with the feedback on those conversations. Knowledge is continuously evolving and being co-constructed. All students who come to Goddard have to answer 4 questions. Some of them we ask right up front. Any prospective student that comes to Goddard is asked immediately as a prospect, what is it you want to learn? The second question is, how do you want to go about learning it? Of course, during their program, they are continually asked, how will we know that you learned what you set out to learn? And finally, what difference will it make in the world? That sits at the heart of a Goddard education. And on that note, I'm going to turn it over to Gus.
Well, one of the, when you think of John Dewey, I mean, one of the first things I learned when I first got to Goddard 20 years ago was from someone named Will Hamlin, who was really there when Goddard started. And he said to me, to understand Dewey, you have to realize that he was a back home philosopher. He meant to get his hands dirty. He'd roll up his sleeves and get his hands dirty in the real world. And that's always stuck with me. I've since heard Paul Kurtz say that Dewey's pragmatism is really the most original philosophical contribution that the United States has made to the world. I find that quite fascinating, and I think that it's continued throughout the years at Goddard, and that is connected to humanist principles of doing good things in the world. So pragmatism, in this sense, started really in the 19th century, reached its peak between the wars, and has sputtered along ever since. There's been certainly been ebbs and flows of that. Now, one way that I think it's interesting to situate Dewey is to recognize that he was born on the same year that Darwin's On the Origin of Species was published. So he's a product of that intellectual times that saw thinking and human cognition as the way to solve problems. And Goddard comes out of that. Dewey actually signed the first Humanist Manifesto in 1933. And he saw humanism as the expansion of human life and understanding through experience. So just like Barbara said, we keep coming back to this notion of experience at Goddard. To know for real means to get involved in the world and try it out for yourself. So ideas are seen as tools or instruments that should be tested by their consequences in the real world through thoughtful action in order to improve the world. Dewey and inquiry, in this sense, is not about receiving truths from the past or rote learning of any kind whatsoever, but it's the active communal research process that focuses on investigation, research, reason, and the scientific process. Dewey wanted to teach people how to think, not what to think. And we keep coming back to that point at Goddard all the time. This is not about what to think. It's how you can apply these methods in order to figure out what you need to know. So inquiry, in this Deweyan sense, is a well-organized method for resolving conflicts, knowing that all such resolutions of these real conflicts result in new conflicts that require a renewed process of inquiry. So in that sense, you've got this cyclical process. You never know. You always strive to know. We need to become comfortable with uncertainty in order to make this happen, since answers to such questions lead to more questions and a renewed process. Now, to be clear, Dewey hoped for what he called warranted assertability on subjects. In other words, we can reach a point where we assume we know this for now. It's a warranted assertability. But ultimately, you always recognize that you're subjecting that assertion to further research. So you're open to the possibility of it changing. Sounds familiar to people who have been humanists for a while. It's ultimately it's flexible, experimental, skeptical, always in search of further evidence. So for Dewey, science, in this sense, means rigorous, orderly thinking to the problems of life identified by individuals aimed at making life better for all. He recognized the relationship between all organisms and their environment that should not be overlooked. So we are social creatures. We need to situate the analysis in the world, in our environments. Knowledge is gained from such a process must have communal application. So it's not just about learning about something, it's about now what do we do with it? So science, reflection, and cognition is at the service of humanity and aids us to strive for our potential. The truth, in quotes, is important to Dewey, but not in isolation. This is important for humanists because while it's important to discover the truth about nature, regardless of its implications to human life, we're not afraid to discover things that maybe make us feel uncomfortable. If this is where the process of inquiry leads us, then that's where it leads us. Ultimately, though, we need to take that truth and figure out how we can apply it to making the world a better place in some way. Education, in this sense, is not about content, but about method. It is the tool set or methodology. Dewey called this tool set or methodology or what some people will call it the scientific process. He called it the method of intelligence. So the method itself is intelligence. I find that a really interesting way of thinking about it, because you can discover something, but it's that method that makes us intelligent. This method of intelligence is both academically rigorous and democratic. So here's where Dewey maybe leaves off, takes an extra step from some of the scientific thinkers of his time. It's necessary for it to be democratic. He was a philosopher of ethics, as well as education and all sorts of other things. But in terms of his ethics, he very much foresaw what Sam Harris is talking about these days, which is that science and reason can tell us a great deal about our ethical practice and our ethics. Our values are subjects of the method of inquiry and should change as our knowledge progresses. So Harris talks about the notion of human flourishing. So if we can situate human flourishing at the center of our process of a process of inquiry, we can then determine what is best in terms of ethics. It's a fascinating concept that I think begins with Dewey in some way. So for Dewey, ideas begin the process of educational process begins with doubt. There's some sort of challenge to our personal understanding of things. Now, it's important that we situate this doubt within the individual, not a socially isolated individual, but an individual within society. Something happens, doubt arises, a conflict arises. Dewey was always fond of saying, "He who wears the shoes best knows where it pinches." So if we want to figure out what's going on, figure out where the pinch is, and let's work on that. So the method begins with problems and conflicts from students' experiences in the world, and a reasoned plan is developed to deal with such problems. I know that the faculty at Goddard is always trying to articulate that reasoned plan. That's our job as faculty members at the college, is to help students understand that well-reasoned plan for study. So we talk about this planning process at Goddard as the Goddard process. It could also be called the Deweyan process, if you like. What we've essentially done at Goddard over the years is systematize this Deweyan cyclical method of inquiry, where student questions become the focus of the process. Okay, so we might argue that the issues that come up from this conflict that students experience, this doubt, comes from their experiences in the world, from their class and cultural histories. This conflict is the problematic situation that needs to be dealt with. Then we develop a very clear plan for engaging in the study of that question, and that includes, all right, I mean, think about it. If I'm going to study something, what am I going to do? I'm going to see what other people have said about this. Right? Formally, this is called a review of the literature. Informally, it's a natural process that students come up with on their own and in community. How can I study something without knowing what has been said about this in the past? It's a common sense thing. And then, how can I test it in the world? How can I experiment to see if this is valid? How can I test it in the world? And how can I see if it actually has an effect in the real world, if it can make the world a better place in some way? Then the question comes up is, how do we know we've done this? How do we know that we've learned this? This is the evaluation process. Well, at Goddard, one of the interesting things is that it picks up sort of the scientific methods notion of peer review, in that this review process it comes in the form of the community of the students, the peers. It comes from the faculty. It comes from the students' community at home. And it comes from the self-evaluation of the students. So students actively participate in their own evaluation. What we're essentially saying is, you started off with some doubt, with some question. How did it work out? What did you find? And what have you learned from it? Inevitably, this process brings up more questions. And then that's the second part, or if you like, the beginning of the second cycle of the process, so that sometimes the questions are refined. Sometimes they need to seemingly different way. Now, the parallel with the scientific process is, these are implications for future researchers. You know, so this is where you hand off the baton to future researchers and say, what have you found? Or now this is something for you to discover or to look at. So it happens within the student's course of study, and then ultimately when the student graduates, the handoff takes place to future researchers. So the aim is to continually exercise the process of forming and testing ideas in order to enable growth in personal judgment and social intelligence. Now, like Barbara said, this is not a method of cultural transmission, but it's a transformative or constructivist method. It does not stamp all values as equal or concerns or of concern only to the individual. Instead, it stresses the values, that values are developed through thoughtful action in democratic community. Democracy is not just the subject of study. Yeah, this is the interesting thing. At Goddard, democracy is not just something we study, it's the milieu in which we study it. So we engage in democracy as well as the study of it. So faculty, students, peers, community work hand in hand in democratic process in order to help facilitate learning that takes place. So it's not limited to transmitting facts, but to creating the desire to know them through dialogue, in community, discourse, and the ownership of the process it takes to enact personal and social change. So if we were to be critical at Goddard of what we might call conventional education, I think most of us would agree that its failure has to do with democratizing the scientific method or the scientific process and the ownership of its machinery. So what we try to do at Goddard is empower the students with that method, you know, of inquiry so that they become then the engine of that process.
So Barbara's going to invite you into a process, but I want to ask you to just look around the room for a moment, because you might be visualizing, I want to make sure you get the right picture of what you would be seeing at Goddard College as part of a program. If you look around, this is a Goddard residency. There are no students on campus full time. Students come for 8 days to put their study plans and develop their curriculum and the timeline together for each semester. I don't think we have one 18-year-old on campus. There might be one 19-year-old that comes to residencies. Most people, and there are 800 full-time students right now, are between the ages of 22 and 72. And most people are in the age range of 32 to 57. So we look a little different. We want people that Goddard pioneered adult degree programs. Evelyn Bates pioneered adult degree programs 50 years ago. And we've been experimenting with how adults learn for 50 years. Every single student is an experimenter. That's it. No grades. And when we talk about evaluation, not only is there no set curriculum, transcripts are narrative evaluations, very, very detailed. And when an employer asks for a transcript, they get an evaluation of a student that is far beyond what anybody can see through a set of GPAs. They get the whole deal, but no grades. So
as I'm about to invite you to engage in an exercise with us, I want to just underscore something that Julie just said, which is that if you were in a Mephisto the residency, each of you would be developing your own curriculum. There are no courses. Every student's curriculum grows out of their burning questions, the questions surrounding the things that they most want to know. And it's an evolving process, and it's progressive in that each semester's studies builds on the learning of the semester before it. And I have, as I speak to students coming through the program, what's striking is that students come in and think they're about to study something that they most wanted to know. And of course, when you watch the evolution of that as they leave, what they leave with is quite different than what they thought they came in to do. And in fact, it has grown out of the questions that grow out of their questions. I guess I want to say something else about this model. I think it's a very powerful model of education in that it takes a lot of courage and also vulnerability for students and faculty. Because there isn't a set curriculum for faculty to stand behind and deliver. It is really meeting students in the questions that they have that are going to most affect their lives and the world in which they live, that a faculty member needs to meet that student. And for a student, the courage to mine their experience, to raise questions from that experience, and those questions then become a bridge between their own lives and the world out there and the lives of others and the larger world of ideas, is much more vulnerable than standing only at an intellectual distance from that which one wants to know. And so with Goddard, we really ask that people move between standing at a distance and entering in, so that when students leave Goddard, they own what they have learned. It is theirs. They know it better than they know anything because it emerged out of their own questions. And so on that note, what I would love to do is to invite you in to the process so that we can have a discussion in which you have a different sense than you might have now about the process that we're describing. And so what I would ask you to do is to imagine for a moment that you had time and space carved out in your life to study something that you really wanted to study, to really engage in learning something that you've really wanted to know about, and to frame it as a question. And I'd like you to turn to the person sitting next to you, and with that person for the course of the next 7 to 10 minutes, to talk about what it is that you most want to know, and to try to frame a question around that. And then we'll come back together as a larger group.
And turn it into a degree.
Yes, and we'll turn it into a degree. What happens when you invite people to talk about what they want to know? This is exactly what happens, by the way, in a Goddard residency. The room gets filled with passion. When you ask people what they want to know, first what we see happening is very often students are a little shocked by the question. Because in fact they came thinking that we were going to tell them what they needed to know. And so there's that kind of disorientation about, oh, you want to hear what I want to know? And then you hear exactly what you heard in this room was the buzz of people feeling passionately about that. So what we'd like to do is to start collecting some of the, listening to some of the questions that came up. But before we do, I'm just wondering, so what was that like to have that kind of a conversation?
Powerful.
Yeah, that's what students say. What was powerful about it?
You're tapping into something you didn't realize was so close to the surface.
Mm. Yeah. Anybody else?
You're sharing with a complete stranger some of your deeper.
Yes. And in a very short period of time, community gets built that way because people connect around the similarities in what they want to know, but also in the human experience that gets shared as they talk about what they want to know. That's absolutely right. And yes?
Paradoxically, not knowing the other person, you can say, well, then, if I sound crazy, so what? They're never going to see me. So I just went for it. You know, he's going to think I'm crazy. And,
that's great.
You know.
That's great.
And it's exactly what else happens. It's a different, no lid.
Yes.
It's easy. We've been married almost 47
years. Oh, you played it safe.
I was going to say it's not a perfect stranger. Not that I've met him before, but he's a humanist.
Yes.
So
it's, yes.
I guess at Goddard it's another student who is interested in the same thing. So the first portion of the rapprochement is already there.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. There is a self-selection involved in the people who show up and the people who are really ready for this kind of education and those questions early on in the when somebody is a prospect really screens for whether in fact this is a good match or not. And if it's not, we advise them to go someplace else and help them to find someplace else to go. But our retention is really high because of that, because the people who come are really wanting to be engaged in this kind of dialogue and education.
So one of the things that comes up during this type of process is the tension between freedom and responsibility. Students often come to Goddard because they like the idea of the freedom to study what they want, and soon realize that now they're responsible for the study. And that's a lot of pressure. That's a, that takes a lot of thinking and a lot of work on their part. So the idea is for the Goddard process, or the this process of inquiry, is rigid from our perspective, but that rigidity, that structure, frees the student to engage in what they need to do. So there's that real tension and freedom and responsibility that I think comes up for people during this process.
So maybe what we can do is hear some of your questions so that we can work with them. So who would like to just...
Here's one.
Somebody's being volunteered.
Right, okay, here. You talk about time and space that a person our age has to make in their life to pursue this. What kind of a system do you have? You say semester. Does that mean you go up to Goddard for an entire semester? Are there, is that the only way to do it? And so forth.
Okay, so you're asking a question about how we're structured.
Yes.
Okay. The way it's structured is that students come in for 8 days, and then in those 8 days, they start out with their question, working in community and with a faculty advisor in an Oxford-like model. The student crafts their next semester's worth of studies. I'm gonna let Gus.
Yeah, so that more. Essentially becomes what we call the study plan, or what might be known as the curriculum. The difference is that it's not imposed on the students, but it's created in the community based on the student's interest. Then they leave the Goddard residency, enter their home community, wherever that is, and engage in that study within the community that they live in. So they'll often use their work experiences as an internship, if you like. And then there's constant dialogue with faculty and peers in the group throughout that semester. And at the end of the semester, then there's a sort of a 360 evaluation. The students evaluate their work, and that becomes part of their transcript, and the faculty evaluates it. The student then comes back the following residency to report to the community. You might call that similar to the defense, although it's not quite as competitive in that sense. But the student comes and reports back to the community and says, this is what I found. Questions arise from that, and the process begins again.
So throughout the semester, a student's work product is typically in packets, and it depends on their program of study, but it's 5 packets. Generally, every 3 weeks, they send it to their faculty advisor. The faculty advisor reads that and sends questions back and encourages the student to think further and look for more information or develop their question more clearly, and that informs the next packet and so forth. So as Barbara said, each semester builds on the prior semester.
This question is based on my own assessment of my own character. I could show up with a question, and you could start the eight-day orientation, and I'd go back home or wherever, and then a few weeks come back and say, you know, I postponed it so much, so I haven't really gotten much done. Then, would you suggest that a more conventional program would be better for me, or would you try to keep on working with me for a while?
Well, I think that we have developed all sorts of techniques, if you like, to encourage, to help people live with that. So one of the things we would do in the study plan process is we would ask questions like, how are you going to keep on top of this? What support mechanisms are you going to put in place for you to carry this out? Also, the biggest challenge, I think, is to continually ask over and over again, is this really personally meaningful to you? Ultimately, if we can engage the student in a question that really comes from them, that they are just burning to understand, that sort of character trait, if you like, will be overcome because they just can't wait to get to this. So it has meaning to them.
Yes, one more question, and then I'm going to bring it back to the exercise. Yes.
You ask, you say, the first question you ask is, what is it you want to know?
Yes.
And then you ask a couple more questions.
Yes.
Then you get in. Then in the discussion you said, and sometimes we have to let the prospective student know that we're not for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is,
oh, no, not the question. Yes, do you
want to
speak to that?
Well, I'm not going to speak totally to the question that Goddard is about. I'm talking to the question of who it is that you're asking to specify what they want to learn. If you're talking about 18-year-olds, you aren't going to get that.
No.
If you're talking to older people who have not had important experiences and aren't able to articulate those things, you're also going to have a hard time, and I assume you have some techniques for doing that. But the really critical issue that you're talking about is that you're not talking about adolescents and you're not talking about young adults. You're talking about people with a lot of experience in the outside world before they want to come back. And they're probably, how old did you say the mean was? 74 years old? They're coming back now to learn. And there would be a great surprise if they didn't have questions at that point, particularly if they have chosen at that point in their lives that they want to come back to college, they want to start learning something, and if they weren't able to specify that, I would agree it would be pretty easy to be able to trick out something that they really do want to do and get into a good conversation. So before you have us ask the question, you should have made it clear, at least in part, when you say, what is Goddard trying to do? You're an adult education program.
Yes.
You're not a standard college age undergraduate.
That's
program.
Right. That's right. That's absolutely
and
right.
That changes the whole ball.
That's right. What I would argue, though, is that many adults have things that live inside of them that they really want to know, that we could call burning questions, for example. But because they've never been asked, and because their lives have been so busy juggling the world, the responsibilities that they have in the world, they've never felt the luxury of allowing themselves even to ask themselves what they want to know. And so, in fact, very often, the process of asking that adult a question of what do you want to know sets up a conflict that brings the person to want to struggle with that. Seeing that struggle would make Goddard say, oh, this person might be a great student here, even though the question is not articulated easily. In fact, the very asking of that question of what do you want to know can be the exact right disorientation that sets somebody up for critical inquiry. Yeah,
but the important thing is that you're directing that to a very specific
component
of the college population.
Absolutely.
Continuing this idea, seems to me that there was a guy named A.S. Neal that wrote a book called From
Young.
Yes.
Yes.
And
yes.
That was not your age range, but it was the regular school age. And the motivation was, when you leave here, what are you going to do? What kind of job are you going to have? And the kids decide they want to be a carpenter. They're going to study what they can find out about carpentry. And it was just an open opportunity for them to work at their own pace.
Right. The difference, and certainly they're related, the difference between the Dewian model and Neal's model is that Neal used traditional classroom methods. The difference was that the kids can choose whether to go to class or not. Okay. But once they were in the class, he just taught like any other teacher would. More or less. At Goddard and the Dewian process, that it's this critical inquiry that rules the day. It's this process of learning it. Since at Summerhill, a lot of the teachers have started to use a different pedagogical approach there. But and I think this comes from when Dewey first started his pragmatist philosophy, and it became known in education as progressive education. That became split quite early on in the soft and the hard wings of the progressive movement. The soft wing was the romanticized, the Rousseauian notion of the child is good, or the student-centered approach. And that's more where Neil was on. Deweyans was, the hard part was using rational scientific measurement techniques to categorize people. Dewey is somewhere in the middle, I would say, and I would say Goddard is somewhere in the middle as well.
I'd like to draw a connection as a, going through the process myself, and being within the demographic that you just identified is that I had rich world experiences and had a targeted question in mind. But nonetheless, I think as it's being demonstrated, it can be tweaked to various demographics. We have an author in the room, an educator, who wrote a wonderful book called Wounded by School. And I can't help but note that the way this conversation started after you had your small pair conversations was that it was empowering. And that the Goddard process, the Dewey process, is an empowering, and it is a healing by school. It is a transforming by school process, and thus can be found, can find its place in ways for people that are drawn to it. The questions can be very articulate. I had a very specific question. But they can also be broader. It can be that I know that I am into food. I want to know more about food. That could be it. And you can go from there, and that will lead you on to this process of inquiry that's designed well to lead you to a rigorous investigation of food.
Yes.
I just have a question I'm curious about, and I don't know if you know the answer to it or not, but in New Hampshire, near where I live, a couple of years ago, a school opened up called, I think it's the Goddard School of Early Childhood Education.
Yeah, we're not related.
Not related.
We're not related.
Do they have a right to use that?
Unfortunately, yes.
One thing that I did like very much about Neil's book was he was so damned honest. The kids didn't learn very much.
Goddard does have specific degree programs with very specific degree criteria because Goddard is accredited like every big institution that you know of. It's how you meet the criteria that has flexibility. Also, Goddard was a big experiment for residential undergraduate programs. We're just not doing that piece of the experiment right now, and that is in part because the world might not be needing that experiment right now. We may be needing to experiment to use a model that is more relevant to education now, and that's where we are. That's where we're engaging.
This is wonderful. Education demystified.
Yes.
Lowercase e. I went to one of the most intimidating schools in the state. And I sat there dumbfounded. It was an emotional storm.
Yeah.
I really didn't know what to do next. It has a wonderful reputation. The faculty is academically very well equipped, very well trained. And they have all the compassion of a stop sign.
Just a quick question. Did John Dewey himself have any input in the founding of this school or in the curriculum? He died in 53. That was 15 years after the school was founded.
The founding president, Tim Pitkin, went to Columbia Teachers College, where he was very involved with William Hurt Kilpatrick and Dewey. Kilpatrick was a protege of Dewey's. Yes, so very much informed by him. Yeah. I'd like to go back to the exercise and to see if people had questions that they came up with. What do you want to learn? Yes.
Everything.
We could work with that. Yes.
I want to learn, why is it that the United States is such an outlier in areas of religion, creationism, everything? All the studies show the greater the amount of intelligence and not intelligence, education, the greater amount of GDP, all these things, it's perfectly linear, and liberalism, progressive, it's perfectly linear, except for this one outlier. And I've heard of different reasons, everything else, but they always end up being, there's pieces missing.
So I'm gonna just say, let's imagine that we are now in an advising session. You're in a residency, you are this learner's peers, and we are the advisor. And we're all going to engage now in working with this question so that at the end of the 8 days, you will have a study plan that you can take home and work from.
So we're not going to be here for 8 days.
So one of the first questions I think that the community would ask is, let's define some of those terms. So do you have the question written down? Or
why don't you rephrase it?
Let me do a short version of it. Why is the United States an outlier compared to other countries regarding progressivism, liberalism, education, of humanism, of all of these factors?
So we would need to figure out exactly what you mean by these things. Mm-hmm. All right. So we would think we can ask you to consider exactly what you mean by these things. So what does humanism mean? What does progressivism mean? You have an idea. But this is, after all, a process of higher education, so we need to be clear on that. And then, how are you going to learn that?
Well, look at various sociological studies.
I've seen several
of them, but again, there's pieces that are just missing.
All right, so we'll need to look at the studies that have been done. So how do we find out what those studies are? How can we learn what's out there already, what's been done?
Well, like every other piece of knowledge we know today, Google.
Then we would bring the library in to do a workshop about credible sources.
Okay, and then how will we know if you've learned something? How will we know if what you've developed, if what you've learned is valid?
When, like in England, 90% of the people believe in evolution rather than creationism.
So
I come up with a plan for that, an action plan.
Okay, so it sounds like your action plan is one, is what you'd like to do is study how to educate people, or how to create critical consciousness.
Well, I need this question answered first before I go into the following questions of how do we accomplish it.
And that's exactly how the process works. So first we dig into the first one. Let's answer.
I've got to do that
problem?
Question first.
Right. And how will we know we've done it, and how will we evaluate it? What will you produce in order to have the community know that what you've learned? Will you write about it? What will it be? And what is the criteria from which it will be judged? Up front, we're going to ask you to figure that out.
And what program would you recommend that he do this program of study through?
Well,
would you suggest sustainability or education?
I was going to suggest education because that's my program, but also because it sounded to me that your ultimate goal is to educate.
No, I want to transform the world.
Okay. And that's my definition of education.
Right. Well, I'm right with Dewey. You know?
I was actually going to say that you should be in an individualized program where you are designing the program. The question that I was going to follow up with immediately before defining terms is, what is it about that question that's so important to you? What's the burning issue in
that question?
Something
about that is driving you.
Yeah.
You want an early experience? I was in Rock Hill, South Carolina. They were kicking evolution out of the schools. I was the only person in a room of 500 people when I was a young man who stood up for evolution. Yeah. My daughter at 11 years old was beat up every day because of it by the good Christians, and the AHA was the only organization that stood up for me. Yeah.
So that's exactly what happens. You now know something about this person sitting in the room in an educational setting that if you were sitting in a classroom, you might not know. And so community gets built around those kinds of shared experiences in which each person's story we encounter language, culture, ethics, understandings about our world that we wouldn't have access to if we didn't ask the kinds of questions that we ask. And so now that you've located that early experience, that might actually affect the way you go about doing your study. So it went from an intellectual question to a question that involved your being, right? What you know and what you want to do. And those three things are at the heart of a Goddard education: being, knowing, and doing. And you just connected them, and they would be connected in the conversation that happens in an advising session. So learning becomes both very personal, it also becomes social, and I would say it becomes political.
In the evaluation process, we ask people to consider those three things: theory, practice, and reflection.
Just a comment about John Dewey. Back in the 1950s, I was in a graduate program, and there was an older gentleman there. He was like 73 or 74 years old, retired physician, that worked for the U.S. Geodetic Society most of his life, been all over the world, but he always went to school somewhere. And he happened to be where he could go to Columbia University. And he took a course in ethics from John Dewey. And he had a question after so many hours of classroom and all that. So he made an appointment to go see the great doctor. And a couple weeks before, he was allowed to go in. And he said, here he was sitting there, kind of a slight man, and those owlish glasses that he wore, round black glasses. He said, yes, and your question? He said, well, how do you know what is ethical? He said, the consequences. You have another question?
I just wanted to, something that struck me as you're talking is that this process seems like it's most effective for only certain types of questions and possibly only certain types of learners, where, you know, the critical thinking, meaning logic and of the traditional analytic methods, that works for, you know, a good group of people, but it's probably going to exclude another group of people who are learn in a different style. And the kinds of questions that it seems are best for this kind of inquiry are more sociological, philosophical, that sort of thing. How would you react to that kind of?
Well, let's take a different question. Do you have a question that represents what you're thinking might be the other side?
No, actually, my question is more sociological. It's about technology as a society, but my...
Actually, what's really interesting is that Goddard has been an incubator for the arts since it began.
Oh, right.
Yes, and in fact, we have an interdisciplinary arts program that, when I really understood what was happening in that program, was it's really a program that looks at the creative process of thinking. And so it's arts as a creative process of thinking. And so I would actually argue that there are all sorts of questions and all sorts of ways that the questions can be asked that would lead somebody into inquiry. Now, the way that people inquire might look different. The method, the way that they enter into the method of inquiry might differ. But I would actually say that we have arts and we have social sciences. And the arts have lived very deeply at Goddard for a long time.
I guess I was thinking more on the technological, things that require a study or something very controlled or something very practical.
Oh, yes, so you wouldn't come to Goddard to learn to be a nurse.
Well, yeah.
Right. But we have a health arts sciences program, which is an interdisciplinary program that brings together health, arts, and sciences.
You would Goddard be the right kind of school for someone who wanted to learn, say, German or mathematics, you know, a field where critical thinking might
science.
Not really be applied to learning that, you know, the level of gaining knowledge, but not critical thinking so much?
for language, for like German, let's just take that as one example, you could, you're not going to, Goddard's not going to provide the immersion experience that you're going to need, but you build out how are you going to learn German. Right. That could be, I'm moving to Germany, and I am going to engage in it this way, and that's going to be part of how I built the program. So that can be addressed. Some of the sciences I'll leave over here.
Okay, so science, I would say that most of the students that come to Goddard to study science are studying environmental science, are studying ecology, are studying, I think that it would be hard for somebody to come to Goddard and do a degree in chemistry, for example. Could they, theoretically? Maybe. We don't seem to get students who are coming to study chemistry. Now, they might need to do a study in which they're interested in chemistry, and that we can do. But a degree in chemistry, I would think that would be difficult.
Certainly every one of us can be better critical thinker. But I do sort of a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. By that I mean, I don't know anybody in this room, really. I spoke to Dave for a couple of minutes, and I know a burning question he had. We're talking to the guy next to us. But just the fact that they're at this conference, in my mind, tells me that I got to be at least 60% right. They're already critical thinkers. Now, there may be some non-critical thinkers in this room, but... So, somebody's going to stick with you and talk about what it is they want to know and how they're going to learn it. You're probably 60% of the way there already, because they're not even going to be talking to you unless they have some reasonable level of being critical thinkers in the first place. So I guess I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, I think that it lives on a range. So I think we have very sophisticated thinkers who are attracted to Goddard because it's a place for them to do that. And then I think there are people who come because they've heard that Goddard is a place where you can do your own thing. And they and so they know that they can be in charge of their studies, but they might not be as adept at critical thinking.
But to this gentleman's burning question,
yes.
Shouldn't we be trying to get those 500 other people that were in that room with him and his 11-year-old daughter, they the ones that we really want to get to become critical thinkers?
Absolutely, absolutely. So one of the challenges, I'll speak about one of the challenges for Goddard, for example, is we tend to attract students who are at the liberal end of the political spectrum. And it's self-selecting. I actually would like Goddard to be a place that, in a democracy, invites pluralism. And I'm thinking about how do we attract people from the more sort of right, Republican, conservative. Recently, I had a conversation with a student community group. They invited me to come to speak with them, and they were talking about democracy and Goddard, and I raised the challenge with them. I said, you know, are you speaking to the choir? How many of you are sort of right-wing Republicans in the room? How many of you are libertarians? And when I left, a young man came running after me. It was the adult undergraduate. He was probably 28. He came running up to me and he says, okay, I'm going to come out of the closet. I don't usually do that at Goddard, but I'm a Republican. Thanks for saying that. So yes, people self-select in the same way that people self-select to be here. That's right. But I think within that self-selection, you find a range of skill and ability and in terms of the development of individuals' voices. So I think there is a way Goddard contributes to people being able to be more public about what they think and know and how they think and know. And then I think there are people who come because it's a place with it already sophisticated. Yeah.
And a lot of what we do is help students become aware of how they can bring these critical thinking skills to their work and their lives. So in the teacher education program, for example, the students will then take these ideas and apply it to their work. So it filters down in that sense, but I think you're absolutely right. There is a lot of that
issue. Yeah, I'm a Goddard alumni, and on this subject of how to engage with the world, which is very Dewey-esque and very much a part of the Goddard experience, while Goddard doesn't have grades, it does have standards and criteria and rigor, and one of the criteria of anyone getting their degree is it's not an ivory tower institution, just as Dewey was not an ivory tower philosopher. And one of the criteria is, okay, you've studied this, how do you now engage with the world with some sort of what sort of activism can you perform in the world to bring what you've learned out to the world? And it is one of the degree criteria. You don't get out simply having noodled on a subject. You get out having performed advocacy or education or training of some sort. And that is, I can't remember exactly what, but I know it's part of the degree thing.
Yes.
You spend either a semester doing it or do something that engages the world with the thing that you've learned, whether it be a social issue or an art issue. If you're a potter, you've got to go out and teach pottery somewhere doing something. So it's not simply social issues, but engaging in the world with what you've learned is an important degree criteria.
Carrie Turnbull is also a trustee for the college, too.
Is there anybody who hasn't asked who would like to before I... Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to call this that harrowing few minutes between the end of a work shift and getting to the library 10 minutes to closing. Finding the book, hoping that nobody's taken it out of circulation, finding it, going to the index, finding out that specific thing, opening it up, and being able to say, yes, at last. That to me is, I guess, on a par with what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what we hear a lot from the students who come.
The pain of doing a term paper, you say.
One question, which has been fascinating me more and more, is how you can find out what people really believe on religious issues, because I realize there's a difference between what a person says he or she believes, what they think they believe when they don't have to please a questioner, and then what they really believe, because people don't necessarily really know what they do believe. And the Pew Research Center only gets answers to that first question, and how could I develop non-invasive techniques for finding out what they really, really believe? I would have to learn a lot more psychology, or it would go on and on and on.
That's it, exactly. It would go on and on, and that's the beauty of this.
Lifelong learning.
Right.
But you've already identified some of the places where you would need to go. You need to go to psychology. You might need to go to what are the interview protocols that are in place that we know about that
methodological
might edit those
issues.
Things.
Yeah.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. I have a completely self-serving question. How do you select faculty for your school?
How do we select faculty? I don't select faculty.
We
programs.
We advertise.
Yes,
right.
The programs state a need. There's a call that goes out. Jobs are posted. People come and interview, and part of what I would say is it's not just about people who might know this model. So it's not just about hiring, because the faculty at Goddard are an interesting faculty. They're dispersed. There are very few full-time faculty. We have half-time faculty, but we have faculty who are out
employed elsewhere, engaging in their practice, and they come in because they have expertise in a particular area.
And they love this model.
Yes.
Right, so it's not just a matter of finding the person with the expertise right. in that particular discipline. That's very important, but they need to also understand this model of doing
and
the work.
And they have to like it.
And they have to like it, and they have to like people. Because it's very difficult to listen to someone struggle with their question.
So,
very difficult.
www.otter.edu/HR.
I guess what I would say about that also, it's education for human development. And human development is a slow process. And so you really have to hang in there with people as they sort of work that.
So I have a question about your sense that this is really only an adult education. I've worked with lots of adolescents and younger folks who have a very passionate sense of what they would like to know and are impeded by the schools that they're in experiencing that and exploring that.
So what I would say is that what we've presented here is an adult model, but there are developmentally appropriate ways to apply this to younger people.
And I would even say what we're talking about, Montessori talked about. I mean, we're talking about Montessori education. In fact, if you look at adult learning theory, it's Montessori for adults. So at the moment, Goddard's newest experiment is around one of its most successful experiments, which was its adult learning program. And in fact, in the 1938 charter of the college, one of the founding principles of the college was adult learning, that learning should be lifelong and for adults as well. But it is Montessori education.
Right, Montessori with Reggio model, which is modeled on Dewey. There are lots of other approaches.
Yeah, I was going to say, I went there when I was 18, so that was a long, long time ago. And at the time, those of us who were there all were the age when I, because it was a different place in time. And we all had the attitude, not this isn't for young people, but anyone over 30 we didn't have any interest in and thought would be so out of place at that school. So things have flipped a bit here. But I would say it's not a mass education. And I often, as a trustee, am astounded that there are only 800 Goddard students, because my thought is, how many people are about to graduate from public high school on Long Island, where I went, and enter a meat grinder of a public university system, who, if they knew this existed and had some sense of what it was, would think that's like save my life. So I think that there's probably out of the, I don't know how many kids are in college now, millions. There's plenty of room for young or old here. I think it's probably a model that's applicable, but not to everyone instantly. But I think there's probably a lot of applicability there.
So
I just wanted one last thing. Before you think my daughter was totally damaged by that experience, she's a strong humanist and is the resident director of the new Broadway blockbuster show, The Book of Mormon, which is a totally humanist message. In fact, she called me up, she laughed, she said, Dad, you'll love this. We put in a line in the show that says, well, what if there's no God and all we have to do is just try and make a paradise on earth? So when you listen to that, you're listening to 11-year-old girl in Rock Hill, South Carolina, that got beat up because she was a humanist.
Thank you very much, and it will be here if you have want to come up and ask questions.
There are issues of our latest community magazine in the back, and please take them and please ask us questions. We'd love to talk to you.
And come to Vermont to visit.